How should a church address teachers who present false ideas to the congregation? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, your host and study guide author, and we're continuing a 13-week series on the New Testament books of 1 and 2 Peter, and my conversation partners throughout this quarter are Drs. Jody Washburn and Dr. Alden Thompson. Both are professors of Old Testament at Walla Walla University, and the question that we open with today really takes us right into a challenge that 2 Peter chapter 2 presents, and that is the issue of false teachers within the church. And we've discussed this subject a bit previous to this on-air broadcast, but some of the challenges that we have when we think about false teachers in the church, one of the first responses, Jody, that you had, I'd like for you to share it.
Oh, I just say that hearing that question, how should a church address teachers who present false ideas, my initial reaction is just to think of Matthew 7, that I have a plank in my eye. Who am I to judge? And that maybe in many circumstances when I notice something that seems false, there's still a lot of work I can do in my own life. Not that there's never a circumstance, you know, when we need to speak up and hold each other accountable.
But your first response is one of hesitation to,
yeah, do not judge.
And I need to be careful. I need to be careful that I don't just say, well, it's automatically false, and therefore I'm going to have nothing to do with the person. Maybe there's some truth in what they're saying, and I need to listen.
Well, the interesting thing about it is it depends on how a person is presenting something. One person can present an idea that the church will rise up and say, this is wonderful. But that same idea with just a very slight shift, the church will rise up and say, that's ghastly. You are a heretic. See? So I think that we need to explore how we can help people. And the idea of not being too quick to judge, I think, is an important one.
It just seems to me that it's so easy when judging. Like when we use a label, we are deciding should someone be categorized as false or true, right? But if you look at what Peter's mentioning, I mean, he talks about these false prophets. They're denying the sovereign Lord who purchased them, who brought them, who bought them. They're working from greed. They're exploiting people.
This is
very conceptual. It's not simply someone who uses the wrong wording for their interpretation hermeneutic or their...
Or they've read the wrong book.
Or they've memorized a text that is not one of the central texts and they're trying to push this you know, side idea. This is people who are, in a way, embodying the principles that are directly opposite of what Jesus embodied. And I think we can learn from that in a sense that we do need to hold each other accountable. When we see greed, like if we see greed or arrogance or you know, denying the gift of Christ that Christ has given us, then we need to hold each other accountable.
So if somebody is in the church and they profess to be a member in good and regular standing, and maybe even more so an elder, a leader in the church, or maybe even a pastor, but at some level they are denying the fundamental tenets of Christianity, the coming of Jesus, his lordship in our life, and the gifts that he gives, at some level, what do we do then? How should the church address someone like that? Because I agree with you, Jody, there's a sense in which I don't want to judge, and I have always hated conflict. Just when I was pastoring, I didn't like conflict, but sometimes you have to deal with it. Is there a sense in which, for the sake of the members in the congregation, something should be said, something should be done? And if so, what is that?
Lots of prayer.
Ah, good place to start.
Not to speak too soon. I don't know.
Well, I think of, you know, I was impressed even before Seventh-day Adventists organized the church formally. You still have record of them disfellowshipping people. And it typically wasn't for major heresy. It was just being ornery.
Because they didn't get along.
You can split the church on just about anything, see. And it's possible to have all kinds of wild heresy. I remember many years ago, one of our secondary schools, there was a teacher who had an unorthodox understanding of the Trinity. Okay? And it came to the place where it was sufficiently troublesome, they formed a committee to deal with it. And I remember one of my colleagues at the time, Larry Lewis, who was on the committee, he said, man, you think if this man who's accused of heresy, you think that's bad, you should hear the view of some of the people on the committee. But the people on the committee hadn't made an issue of it. You know, they had these wild ideas, but they kept them to themselves. You can even take an Orthodox idea and split the church. So, yeah, we have to be careful, and by their fruit you shall know them. What's the result in the life of the church?
And Jody, you had alluded to a couple places in the passage here where it gave specifics about these teachers, but when it says that these people are greedy and they're ultimately destructive, does the Christian congregation need to fear such false teachers? Is there a sense in which it can happen today? Could it happen in a local congregation? I fear that it could, but there's probably a sense in which we recognize the tent stakes of our community should be broader than just everyone agreeing with everyone on every little minute detail, because I don't know that that's actually possible anyways, but there's a fundamental level of faith. I'd like to move on to the next section. Peter talks about judgment, and it's much like 1 Peter in the section on the harrowing of hell. We have a section here that is a challenge often. Verses 4 down through 10, he says, "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and he did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, and condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. And he delivered Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man, dwelling among them, tormented his righteous soul from day to day, by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment." And I think I'll stop there. This is a hefty passage, but he brings three examples of judgment and then of deliverance, right? He talks about the God not sparing the angels who sinned. And then he talks about the ancient world with Noah and the flood. Then he brings up Sodom and Gomorrah. But in the process, he doesn't just point out the wicked. He points out that there was deliverance for some, right? In the flood, there were the eight who were saved. In Sodom and Gomorrah, it says that Lot was saved, but it uses that word righteous Lot. And when you two are Old Testament scholars. Tell me about the righteousness of Lot for a moment.
That's a euphemism.
Or is it a relative word, relatively speaking?
See, the New Testament often takes great freedom with the Old Testament stories, just like all storytellers do, I think. But, for example, Sarah in the Old Testament laughed at the angels. You won't read that in Hebrews. Mm. You know, it's only the Old Testament, and that's one reason why we have to let each inspired voice speak for himself or herself. Don't ever try to merge them and make them all say the same thing. It's clear here that Peter wants to use Lot as an example of someone who's been rescued.
And when we look at the overall context of Abraham arguing with the angels about who would be saved, you know, in Sodom and Gomorrah, if there are only 30 people, only 20 people, only 10, will you save them? And God says, yeah, I'll save the whole city, even if there's only 10 righteous. In the end, how many are righteous? Well, we see four people taken out. One looks back, Lot's wife, and really there's only three left. But are they truly righteous? Maybe in contrast with Sodom and Gomorrah, perhaps. We see Lot in his relationship with the angels who come into the city. He wants to preserve them. He seems to have a little different heart than those around him. But is he a perfect man? Well, look what happens with Lot and his daughters afterwards, right? Mm-hmm.
But he is not quite as bad there as the stories would make it, because the daughters preserve their father from moral guilt by getting him drunk first.
He has no culpability
in that sense. And getting drunk is probably worse than having inappropriate relations with your daughters.
But these three examples, the angels who sinned, the flood story, and Sodom and Gomorrah, examples of judgment. And for Peter, he's suggesting that there will come a time of judgment on these false teachers. But is it our job then to bring judgment on the false teachers?
Yeah. I think I said that wrong. I think having inappropriate relationships with your daughters is much worse than getting drunk.
Yeah. Certainly so.
Yeah.
Is there a sense in which God has a judgment that is going to come? Do we look to a judgment today? Jody, you already said at the very beginning, we don't like to judge one another. And it seems like this culture, that is the watchword. You know, judging is the highest sin that one can commit among
others. But stand in the face of divine judgment in the end, I think, is a pretty crucial issue. To know that you will be held accountable is important. And one of the tragedies in the part of the world where there is no longer any respect for police or any kind of authority, the world just falls apart. And I don't know how obedient any of us would be if we knew that we weren't going to be caught or wouldn't have any penalties for our misjudgment. It's kind of like, would you stay within the speed limit if you were absolutely sure that there would be no reprisals? You're out in the middle of the desert, nobody around anywhere. Would you open it up? Well, there are some states that allow you to do that, or at least they used to.
Right. I remember hearing about Montana out in the rural areas, no speed limit. If there's no law and no accountability, then is it just anarchy? But this sense in which there's a future judgment, and yet is there good news for those of us who think about judgment?
I think that's the point that Peter seems to be making here, that yes, accountability is coming, responsibility, right? That there is a consequence, so to speak. But like Jacques Ducan points out when he studies Daniel, that judgment in the Old Testament is almost invariably in favor of the people of God. So in other words, it's good news. It's a rescue. It's a renewal, redemption. And I think Peter is pointing out, Peter's pointing out those two sides.
And that the false teachers in this community, while the people may not have power to do anything about them, in fact, Peter doesn't even say kick them out necessarily. He just begins to describe them and says, God has judgment laid up in store for them. And verses 11 all the way down through verse 17, perhaps verse 18, describe these ungodly people, and it talks about some of their characteristics. Yeah, maybe all the way down through 19. And yet, God is going to be the one who ultimately judges them. Maybe that can be relieving for those of us who feel like it's our job to say something, to point out challenges in the congregation. I'll leave it up to those of you who are listening in to study along with the study guide on the rest of this section. I wish we had time to look at the origins and conditions of the false teachers. But one thing I'd like to point out, these false teachers had once tasted of the good word of God. It seems like at one point they had a holy experience. And hopefully you don't have that challenge in your own life. My thanks to my colleagues today for your help and conversation. My thanks to Jared Miller, our program engineer. Thank you to all of you who are listening in. For The Good Word, I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.